November 9th, 2008 is the Watt from Pedro Show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Watt from Pedro show. Started off with Softly as in a Morning Sunrise, John Coltrane Live, Village Vanguard. And that was suggested to me by one of our many guests, brother man. We have many guests in the house.
Welcome, everybody.
And Skip Heller.
Libra. Aboard. Libra. And my name is Skip.
And
I love all the women.
Which
of the
town?
World. I'm from here, from Inglewood, California.
Okay. And then we heard Flood Part 2 by Boris. Now, we got other people, Mr. Bob Stiers. We'll start
Hello.
From the starboard here.
Yeah, from Edendale, which is where Silver Lake, Elysian Heights, and Echo Park come together.
That's the 90026 zip code.
It's a mic adjustment. Miss Pete?
Hi.
From?
Galasso Park.
Okay. And we have new people. Tanya, of course, an old veterano of the show. Pedro from Ankle, but via Pedro. Or Pedro Villamanco.
Pedro Villamanco.
Now, these are two of your compadres.
Second year anniversary today.
Oh. Yeah.
She's Pedro. I was born in Pedro. Went to Palos Verdes. Back in Pedro for her.
You went from down up the hill?
Back
when
down.
Does that ever
Wow.
That's cool. And Coco and...
Matt.
Yeah.
And Pete, you should introduce your... Because last week we had Mark Stangroom, who was a couchsurfing.com a connected peak appendage. Or not appendage. what was it? Colleague?
Sure. I brought...
Associate? What would you call it? What would you?
This one, he's a world-class photographer.
Okay.
Giovanni Del Brenna. Is that... Did I say that right?
That's okay.
Giovanni...
Better than average.
Say it.
And you're from...
I'm Italian, but I do live in France, so that may be why she said the word.
What part of Italy?
I born in Genoa.
Yeah, okay. Near France.
Near France, yeah.
In fact, I think Genoa, kind of Italian version of Geneva.
It's pretty far away, but...
Yeah, I know, but the name...
Yeah, people just mix them up.
Okay.
They have a lot more money than us.
Genoa, I found, had the closest weather. To SoCal of Europe.
Yeah, it's pretty nice weather.
By the water, it's not too cold, not too hot.
That's what Phil Alvin says.
Yeah.
He said it was, you know.
Man,
I felt right at home here.
If you got Phil Alvin corroborating your idea. Good. So we got a full house, and somebody's on the way?
Shani.
Right.
En route.
So we won't speak for her. She bringing her pieces of cellophane?
I don't know what she's got going on.
We got a surveys?
Oh, yeah.
Bob, thanks so much.
Distribution.
Let's get some distribution.
You get here late, you have to. Can you catch?
Yeah, no.
Oh,
now, Skip.
Yeah.
You just came in from West Virginia.
I was just in West Virginia.
Yeah, because you are a working musician.
Yeah, actually, this week I was a working awards presenter. I was inducting Robert Drasnan, who's a great film and music. Film and television music composer into the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame. So I got to give the speech whereby they inducted him, which was great. But I got to hang out with Cowboy Jack Clement, who produced all the Johnny Cash stuff on Sun.
Which town?
This is in Charlie West, Charleston, West Virginia.
Yeah, right, the big town.
And he was there presenting the same award and doing the induction for Frankie Yankovic, who was the first million-selling polka artist. And the whites were there, you know, not the Klan whites, but the country singing group, you know, the family group. And they were inducting Stoney Cooper and Wilma Lee, and they were fantastic. And Peter Rowan was there, and Peter Rowan was inducting the Lilly Brothers.
Wow.
I got to pick with Peter Rowan, and he was staggering.
Yeah.
He was amazing.
Did you drink any shine?
You know, there was shine all over the place, but I have been alcohol free since 1992.
Ah, shineless.
So yeah, I was shineless. So I just took pictures and got people to buy me dinner based on the content of those pictures.
Wow. Oh, and you worked with Intro.
I'll tell you, man. I wrote my thing over and over about 9 times. Finally delivered it. Cowboy Jack Clement sees like the vignette, the video thing they show beforehand, and goes, well, I don't know what to tell you now, because everything I wrote down, they already said. So, Frank liked hot soup. Hotter soup than I ever saw. And everybody, he's talking like right off the top of his head for 3 minutes, and everybody's just sitting there wrapped.
It didn't matter what kind of soup it was. It just had to be hot.
It just, that was, he said, he didn't care what kind of soup it was. It just had to be hot.
What about kidney filtered?
You know, I didn't really ask about kidney filter. I didn't have any questions about the renal system as a general thing, but Cowboy Jack Clement might be the coolest white person I have ever seen.
Oh, respect.
Much respect. I mean, he was the guy who, he produced more great records, and he's one of the few men that's been made by longevity and not ruined by it.
And, you got some 78s? Was it on this trip?
No, it wasn't on this trip.
Was here in town?
I was here in town. Actually, what I did was I scored over at Mr. Phil Alpin's house.
Right, some 78s, right?
Yeah.
Only the first 200.
Yeah, only the first 200 out of about 800. But these were the 200 that he deemed necessary. And when, you know, those of you who know your L.A. music know that the Blasters know a few things about necessary old records. As would I say, so did most of the groups that were really good. You know, the L.A. Yeah. punk bands I came up on had a better historical grasp.
You know Carlos Gutiérrez?
Yeah, sure.
Because he's been a guest on the show. Mm.
Oh.
He had kind of a grasp.
Well, that's because he has big hands.
Graspable.
He's also got the heaviest strings on his guitar of any human being.
Yeah.
You know, he just goes out to bridge and just tears cables off with his bare hands.
He had some interesting stories.
Oh, I'm sure.
And you raised here?
No, I was raised in Philadelphia.
You know, Coltrane lived there a while.
Yeah, Coltrane lived in North Philly.
Right, I went to his house this trip.
Yeah, and, you know, I've met Cousin
Mary.
Mary's
still living there.
Yeah. I've met Cousin Mary.
I was afraid, you know, I wanted to come up to the door, but I thought, she don't need another.
I played at some Mount Airy Jazz Festival or something like that. I forget what it was. It was in Mount Airy, and they were giving her some kind of plaque or something, you know, for caretaking the house, because... Yeah. It is an important thing.
Yeah.
Although the one that I got to say is just the most, I was like, had a lump in my throat and crying, was going to Louis Armstrong's house in Queens.
Yeah.
Which has been restored to the condition it was, the furnishings, the whole thing, as when he was alive. And that's just a beautiful place. I mean, I'm not a religious man, but that was as close to a temple as I've ever walked into.
Yeah.
You know, that was big for me. Louis Armstrong is the spirit of all our American music in so many ways.
He's good.
Yeah, he was good.
A lot of Malta.
Well, you know the Nixon story,
right? That's what I heard every day.
That voice.
Yeah, maybe that's...
That gravelly voice.
Yeah, it's
he's cool people. You read the Miles autobiography?
Yeah.
And he kind of bums on Satchmo with a smile.
Yeah, and all I can think is Satchmo had that thing, and Dizzy had this thing, too, where... I mean, it could not have been all that fun to be black during that period in history. You know, because look at it this way. You can't even eat what you want. You eat what you can find. It's not like, you know, you can walk into any city and go, hey, I wonder where the Italian food is, or let's get Mediterranean. You're staying in a boarding house.
Yeah.
And Louis Armstrong had the thing of like...
There's two unions in town here.
Yeah, 767
musicians.
And 47.
Yeah, what was that about? The enlightened musicians even had...
You know, and Jim Crow crap. And this was the only city, Los Angeles was the only city where Louis Armstrong ever got thrown in jail. So think about it. But Louis Armstrong had that thing of, I will smile through anything and you will not kill me. But people tend to forget that, you know, when Faubus came down with all his, you know, evil...
You know that Mingus?
Oh, yeah, Fables of Faubus. Yeah. But let me tell you something, man. When that was going on, Louis Armstrong was on the front page of the newspaper calling Faubus a thug, which for a, quote, black man who knows how to keep his place was unheard of. I mean, Louis Armstrong was a strong, strong cat.
Yeah, yeah, I'm into him. You know? I love his playing, his heart, his soul. I guess he was learned off the guy King Oliver or something?
Yeah, King Oliver was kind of...
Riverboat stuff?
Yeah, well, he played on the riverboats. He learned from Joe King Oliver. And he was also, and this is an interesting thing, Louis Armstrong left thousands of pages of diaries and memoirs. And, you know, when he first got some money, and remember, this is like a black kid who spent his time in reform school, you know, the whole thing, roughly around the turn of the century. First thing he goes out and buys is a record player and a typewriter. And he wrote down all these memories of New Orleans, and he's the only eyewitness account by a trumpet player we have of Buddy Bolden's trumpet playing. And Buddy Bolden is, you know, the first jazz musician that anybody calls a jazz musician, but there are no recordings of him. So for an actual trumpet player to say his sound was like this, he played like this, and these were the tunes he played, is a major historical coup.
You know about the word jazz?
There's all kinds of theories about
the word
jazz.
Here's the theory I heard, short for a jazzman, because casa de putas, and smell. And then also there's a lot of sounds going on, so they... not record players or radio yet, so they needed cats to play all the time, and so the improvising came out.
Well, that's why if you notice the first bunch of Louis Armstrong Hot 5 records are like, you know, Mahogany Hall Stomp. Well, what do you think Mahogany Hall was? Mahogany Hall was a house of questionable repute. You know, and there were a lot of, you know, Black Horse Stomp by Fletcher Henderson, also a house of questionable repute. I submit
the
now.
The House of the Rising Sun.
Yeah, well, I've been there. You know, anybody who's taken the coach tour in New Orleans has, they pointed out. You know, there's the House of the Rising Sun. You know,
it's funny, the Lead Belly. I mean, everyone knows the Animals, right?
Yeah.
I guess there was a Frigid Pink. There was a cover of the Animals version.
Yeah.
But the Lead Belly version is so, because he played this 12th. I think he had high action.
Yeah.
And it's like jumpy and happy.
Yeah. Well, have you ever heard Gallows like. Pole? You know, it's a song about a guy getting hung. It's like, woohoo, get the gallows pole. Read me my rights. Hey, oh, you know.
The bourgeois blues.
Yeah, yeah.
But his style, you know.
You know,
he
was a wild guitar player. You know, yeah. Blind Lemon Jefferson. But interesting thing about Lead Belly, though, and think about this. All the blues singers that we have records of,
yeah.
Up until Lead Belly, all we have them doing is singing blues. But we know that these black singers were being hired by white people to entertain white society. And as a result, we know that they knew certain other kinds of music. But Lead Belly was the first
one. Work the room.
What's that?
Work the room.
Lead Belly worked the room. So he was the first cat that we had who, when Lomax recorded, he said, play everything you know. And again, as a result, because of...
Shut your leash off! God damn it.
Plus, he was always in prison, too, so he used to use his songs to get favors and stuff.
Right, but when he was out on the outside...
He socked somebody to death.
Yeah. He had an enormous scar across his neck.
Yeah, right.
But with Lead Belly, he's the first guy that they recorded everything that a blues guy knew. And that's where we get Dancing with Tears in My Eyes and Gallows Pole, all this different kind of material. And these are kind of the missing links of our American music. You know, the thing that ties white people to black people, which is usually one of them hires the other to entertain the other.
Yeah, Lomax, Don Fleming's working for his, like, foundation that went and archived a lot of
it. Yeah. It's a really important and very misunderstood chapter in American music because everybody wants to talk about authenticity. But the funny thing is the minute you want to make a dollar in this business... You get less authentic because you want to be able to
Elvis,
cross.
Did you ever see a Louisiana Hayride where he starts to say business, but then he says racket?
Yeah,
racket.
It's a lot.
I wish it was a business.
But I mean, like at whoever stayed authentic, and they couldn't even work across the street.
Or somebody like me, as crude as me, that is not very authentic, but there's so much blues in my playing.
I always just thought of you as playing the authentic Mike Watts San Pedro style, just like, you know, when you hear...
But I mean, there's a lot of blues.
Yeah.
Because I learned maybe from England rock and roll, Entwistle and Bruce.
Sure.
And there's this is the thing we were talking about last week, me getting this Lifetime Achievement Award, and there was a lot of fusion players.
Mm-hmm.
And that music, it's kind of if you're watching a talk show... those kind of sounds or the commercials and stuff.
Yeah.
And I noticed they asked for my missing man, so I have a band of two longshoremen here in Pedro, organ based drum trio, and it's got so much more blues, not on purpose, it's
just the way it comes out,
the way it came out. They it is an authentic U.S. music blues, I think. And I think the U.S. people in the early 60s kind of lost it, and the England people had to show it to them again.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
You know, and then and what happens, like the next major blues soloist really is Eric Clapton.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And, you know, than the next generation
of
America.
Comes out of Mayall. There's
Peter Green.
Yeah.
He's already coming out of a tradition in England, though. Mayall. He's
apprentice. Peter Green is like another guy.
Peter Green's a little later.
Yeah, but like, can you explain Carlos Santana without Peter Green?
No.
No, of course. You wrote the song.
Not as good a song either.
You know, and then what happens is the next generation of American electric players has, you know, is coming out of Cream and is coming out of Hendrix.
Right, right.
And that's how, you know, that's why we still have blues, is because it's not just locked into 1947 or whatever year you want to pick. Although that 20s said...
20s with Charlie Patton or something.
Well, I mean, that said, though, I think the minute you lose your connection... One of the reasons I just find myself playing less and less jazz is because it's just, it feels so much like it's lost the connection to what I feel is the thing, which is like that Count Basie notion of swinging, like four quarter notes just lifting you up, almost like water coming up under you. Like, it's a hard thing to explain, but I know what it is when it's missing from what I'm trying to do.
You know, in training, though, you hear a lot of blues.
Totally, yeah. I mean, but anybody... Well,
even when he took it out to that Sheets of Sound thing.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, you listen... Like, any player that knocks you out that contains some element of improvising, whether you're talking about Derek Bailey or E-sharp or Zorn or whatever, there's some reference to the blues.
Oh, that's funny you say that, because I was in a tour last February in Japan, and I got to play with... The first gig in Tokyo was with Han Benek.
Oh.
And this cat, he knows that scene, that avant-garde, and he was telling me about... They got their shtick and their hustle and no blue notes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what do you mean no blue notes?
Because they're trying to get away from the American thing. It's a lot like if you look at like about 1910 in France, there was this bunch of guys in English, it's the six, you know, Honegger, Poulenc, Miot, and all this. And what they were doing is saying, none of this kind of counterpoint, none of that German stuff. Which, if that period in concert music and serious music is almost like saying to an American musician, none of that blues stuff. Well, you know.
Tough.
Yeah, it's really, that's our vocab. No, not anymore.
And Benek was like, no, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, work the room.
Well, Benek also, you know, he played with Bill Evans. I mean, he had a very conventional.
Played with Adolph.
Yeah, Eric but I'm Dolphin. Saying, you know, Benek could fit into the most conventional situation and be exactly the right guy for the job. Or... You know, he could go into the next region. I mean, he's a very deep musician.
Oh yeah, he'll play the tabletop.
He'll play the tabletop.
I mean, he was great.
But I bet he could play Miserlou in a very straight ahead way too.
Yeah, he told me about playing with Wes Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful man, but he said this thing they were almost reactionary against is no blue notes.
Yeah.
But then you end up with. Especially now, it's 20 or 30 years old. So
and it's like watching a movie that only has good guys in it. You know what I mean? When you only have like one kind of thing, it's like, oh, well, you know.
Scary trip. That's what I liked about the punk thing. It wasn't a style of music.
Well, I think Dee Boone said it best. He said, you know, everything was great with punk rock until you had to put on a uniform and join punk army. And that to me was so... Things are always better when you're making them up as you go along. And that's why I thought when punk rock kind of, you know, went its way. So, like, yeah, the Ramones are kind of guarding this. You know, the three-chord, bar chord, hard right-hand style. And then you see, like, Pill and the Pop Group and the Slits. And it's like, well, you know, we don't hate the OJs. So we like that kind of bass player. We like funky drums. And we like LKJ, Lynn Queasy Johnson. So we like that kind of upfront bass. And then, you know, the guitar playing was totally different. And, I mean, to me, like, the pop group were just like, boing, you know.
You should play some. I got some of them. Where they took a Last Poets song and played along with it. You know that song?
Yeah.
The Last Poets called it E Pluribus Unum. And they translated one out of many.
Yeah.
I guess out of many is one E Pluribus Unum. So they went backwards.
They were on this Iggy. One of these magazines put out had Iggy pick like 45 songs that would be on his Ultimate Jukebox, and he had one of theirs, "Run Nigger Run."
You know, Last Poets, first album.
They're still around.
Yeah, they are. In fact, there's two bands.
Well, it's like a very radical version of the Drifters or something.
Yeah.
Phil Spector told me this great story. He's inducting, he was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they're inducting the Drifters.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were two hit-making Drifters and then, like, 50 bazillion cruise ship Drifters.
Right.
And they said, well, the members of the Drifters, please come to the stage. And every, he said, every busboy and every waiter in there took his apron off and just went.
Here, let's listen to Pop Group.
Are burning like fire among those for the dough, as they continue to keep the people asleep and the truth from being told. Racism and greed will keep the people in need from getting what's rightfully theirs. Cheating, stealing, and double dealing as they exploit the people's fears. And for a few dollars more, they start a war to exploit the government's law. Then there's the pyramid that stands by itself, created by black people's knowledge and love. And over the pit hangs the devil's eyes. And the dog had a king, the people. It's the second place the money was real. Now Seesaw means the treasure, where they store the gold they stole. And Amur means to punish, or like the slaves they bought and sold. But then Septim, a mean seven, or like 1776. Or when the 13 devils gather to unleash their bag of tricks. A little second, a music image they created to fool the world. Or like the colors on old drawings, the flag that they unfurl. And now red for the color of the Indian man, white for the devil who stole the land, blues for the eyes that hypnotize, tricks and caps they spun. And even to this very same day, they all speak with forked tongues. The ruling class, the same God with the face of all the matter, so the people don't get any in the lands of the plenty, cause E pluribus unum means one out of many.
We'll be right back. Sorority queens chew juicy fruit in Topanga Canyon all night. Hitchhikers from eternity flag down your Chevrolet and hug your blue jeans in Barney's Beanery, where they've added another room to hell. The jukebox keeps repeating second-hand rows. And in unison, towards the sunset of Santa Monica Beach, a thousand long fingers of high school sweethearts hold their cigarettes through wisps of smoke. There is a chance, secondhand rose, a star may fall at your feet, but you know that chance withers on your lips as you sing many versions of your love poem. Torn alone in pages of night's tarnished wings of the angel flight. All the way up Sunset's trip, as unlikely as Dante finding self-help programs in heaven. The lights of Los Angeles endlessly hang there, like a hustler's mad beads. Cast your spell on neon dye tonight, dark moon. For tomorrow that ounce of stardust will be wiped from Cadillac chrome, unnoticed by the freeway hawks.
Cody's.
Watt from Pedro show. We just heard some live Minutemen. Is that right? Mr. Stiers.
Yes. I thought it would give a little flavor.
That's from Mr. Stiers' archive.
Fine choice.
This was from Berkeley Square in the fall of 85, and I strongly suggest anyone that wants to find some really great live music sets in their entirety to go to archive.org,
yeah,
which they're putting together the entire digital library, and if you haven't checked it out,
very happy. There's a mic there, Bob.
These are soundboard mixes. I think Mike, has said okay on a couple of these. But they were beef from the Stone. They have some.
Well, this was Berkeley Square in the city of Berkeley, California, 1985. So near the end.
Yeah. But it gives a nice flow of. This show is really well recorded.
And the songs we heard were Toadies, The Big Foist, and Retreat.
Yeah. It gives a nice. Indication of sort of how you guys put together
the three songs off of Double Nickels on the Dime. They got that half step thing. They're kind of major. Minutemen would work in major stuff sometimes. In fact, funny we mentioned Angela because the Big Foist I wrote thinking when we did that one, I said, "Dee Boom, will you sing like Jella?" And I got it was Black Flag. It just took us to England. And the clock on Parliament,
a big band,
yeah. So the intro, fifths.
By the way, you know, Tuesday night, or we're recording this just after Democracy is set about to correcting the long national nightmare. But as I got off the plane, I was getting off the plane, you know, in time to start hearing, like, you know, the calls to the states. It was just 15 minutes before they called it for Barack Obama. All I could think was, who won? I said the election. You know, I was celebrating the 4th in somebody else's city.
Yeah, I wrote that one. I felt like a gringo. Us Minutemen went to Rosarita Beach down in Baja.
Yeah.
And, D. Boone wrote Corona, and I wrote I Felt Like a Gringo. We had two songs come out of our trip.
Was that when you cut your hair?
Yeah, we were bald-headed and out in the ocean about 7 hours. And, you know, you got to breathe. And we had never cut our heads bald before, so we got burned big time. Pelón rojo.
Yeah, well, that's the punk rock affliction, dude.
Yeah. It was because we had a gig with Joanna Wendt. I met a guy. Petra had a gig. She finally, her and Woody had been making this record for 10 years, and they finally put it out, and she had a gig a couple weeks ago, and Joanna Wendt's husband was there.
I just remember, never knew what she did. I just remember her from
performance
that cover
artist
Slash.
Something with yams, I think, that
we
was
did
a little while.
I saw her a bunch. She was very provocative. Yeah. Or goat heads and pulling it out through the wedding gown by the tongue. Things like this. It was very...
You know,
so Debo, it was Georgie's idea. It was actually Georgie's idea to do something as comparatively shocking. But when me and Debo, we cut each other's hair. We didn't know that you're supposed to use clippers first, you know, so we used this Bic razor, and luckily I was first. But our heads looked like motocross track, you know. It was a bloody play. We get up there, and Georgie didn't cut his hair all the way up. He just, like, buzzed it. Remember the first shower I took, it was like snowballs. Okay, and before that, we heard Charles Plimel doing Hollywood Boulevard. And before that was Matt Jones from Western Massachusetts, I think, with Manuscripts 2000 AD. And then from San Francisco, we heard Carolina with Red Lamp of Slow-Willed Souls. And we started off with a pop group doing One Out of Many, which is actually them jamming along with The Last Poets doing E Pluribus Unum. We're at the end of the first hour of the November 9, 2008 edition of the Watt from Pedro show. Hold tight for hour two. November 9, 2008, it's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro show. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Watt from Pedro show. Start off the second hour with something Mr. Skip Heller suggested, provided. Mr. Johnny Guitar Watson with Space Guitar.
That's President Johnny Guitar Watson.
Hi. Cool. And what do you want to say about that tune there?
I just, you know, if I have to pick five guitar records to take to a desert island, that's right up there. That and, I don't know.
Is this from Mr. Phil's collection?
No, this is actually, I've had that record for a long time. Johnny Guitar Watson is somebody that I discovered early on and just loved from day one.
No credit to you, Mr. Phil.
Phil likes him too. Johnny Guitar Watson. Let me tell you about Johnny Guitar.
Of course. Didn't he teach math?
Phil,
Long Beach State.
Yeah, Phil is and if you've got 3 hours, he'll explain what it is he teaches to you. It's semantic theory, as mathematics.
Okay.
He's a brainiac.
And then we heard Bert by Solo Musica. Talia, you want to talk about that?
It's an instrumental. I'm starting to make instrumentals right now.
This is from you.
Mm-hmm.
And you on everything.
Yes.
Hence the name, Solo Musica.
Yes.
And how long ago?
How long ago did I make this? About a month ago.
Okay, so it's kind of a recent thing.
So far, it's just one instrumental that I have.
And then we heard your buddy Coco's band with Aqua Vend. The name of your band is Foxy Autopsy.
That's
correct. So what do you want to say about your band and your song,
Coco? That is the titular song off of the Aqua Vend.
Mad props for good use of the word titular, young lady.
Which is a favorite word of mine. We've had ourselves in 05, I believe. One of our favorites. It's about water. I believe everybody should stay hydrated at all times.
And you're a Pedro band, so you're near the water.
That's right.
So it's kind of has a regional orientation. Application. Better. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Brother Matt. Then we heard something from Matt, your man, A Nation Fit for Heroes, which is something brand new by The Damned.
Yeah.
Heard it first here, Watt from Pedro Show. How'd you get a hold of it, Mr. Matt?
They're selling it at their concerts, and I actually wanted to clarify, I know the Minutemen played Zillas with The Damned, and there were two really funny stories from that show. Captain Sensible traded his punk leather jacket for some cocaine. And the other thing is my brother, who's a total straight edge, walks out of the club, and there's a guy eating a girl out on top of a car, and there's 20 people around cheering.
Oh, jeez.
So
he must have been doing it very, very well.
Any memory of that Zilla show, Mike?
Not that. Came to play.
Hey, she said titular, and I just started rolling on all the unsavory stories.
But that's because nobody dislikes the word titular.
Now, people probably don't know this, Mr. Heller, that Tommy Ramone is doing bluegrass.
Yeah, Tommy and his wife Claudia have a really wonderful duo called Uncle Monk. And my bluegrass group, also my jazz group, played gigs with Uncle Monk, and that was kind of when the jazz group got fired, because I just kept trying to get them to learn, you know, more country blues type stuff. And they were going, gee, we want to play, you know, what jazz groups usually play.
Too much democracy.
No, when you pay them, they're not democratic. They just come in and they're contractors. But it just, I don't know, it's a hard thing to explain, but, you know, you got to do what you want to do, especially when you're not going to make any money doing what you don't want to do. You know, there's no reason to sit around and make a living doing something you hate when you can eke out a living doing something you love.
Okay.
And word to the wise, I never took a gig just for the money and had it work out.
Okay. Now, how'd you get started on guitar?
I used to watch the Glenn Campbell show. And between the Glenn Campbell show and the Johnny Cash show and the Smothers Brothers show, this is back when if you saw somebody on TV playing the guitar, they weren't lip syncing, they were playing the guitar.
Uh-huh.
And Glenn Campbell had a banjo player on the show named John Hartford. And John Hartford just mesmerized me. So what I wanted to do was grow up to play
guitar. How old
were
you?
I was like 3 or 4.
Jesus. You remember shit like that?
I will never forget shit like that.
I can't remember anything after.
You know, I was blessed with a little bit of an early memory, but I just remember like pointing at that and going, I want to play with him. And in later life, because...
How much later?
Oh, I was about 30, I guess, but I got to know John Hartford and open for him and, you know, sit around with him backstage with a guitar and play his songs to him, and he picked up his fiddle and said, oh, no, you want to do this
did
chord.
He
you wanna...
Did he wince?
He was too gracious to wince. Okay. He was
he scowled.
No, he was
sour ass.
No, he was not like that. Jerry Reed was like that. I was playing in the Country Music Hall of Fame once, and Jerry Reed walked by and gave me this look. And Earl Scruggs walks up behind me and goes, "Don't worry about that." He does that to every guitar player.
Oh, wow. But like you were fouling the air.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, there are very few people on earth that can play the guitar as well as Jerry Reed.
He's bad.
He was badass. He was the funkiest white musician this side of Jimmy Johnson. And I gotta say, you know, it broke my heart until Earl Scruggs walks up. Don't worry, he does that to every guitar player. And I was like, okay, sure.
So in between you being backstage with him, and the 3-year-old thing with the television, how did you do the guitar?
You know, just latched on to country music first.
Okay.
And Elvis. Elvis was my first concert. And then in 1977 or 78, I heard the Ramones. And that's when I decided I wanted an electric guitar.
Oh, you weren't playing electric?
No, I wanted to, you know, I was really interested in... I wanted to be Willie Nelson when I grew up, you know, in so many ways.
Right.
Because this is during the time when Merle Haggard and Dolly Parton and Tom T. Hall and Willie are really making their best musical statements.
Buck Owens.
No, Buck was kind of out of the picture at that point. Buck was on Hee Haw, and that didn't really flatter
him. Television.
It was television, but the interesting things on Hee Haw were usually if they had somebody like Loretta Lynn on. And Saturday nights, pretty much like you had in L.A., there was country music programming. We had Pop Goes the Country, the Porter Wagoner Show, Wilburn Brothers Show, and that good old Nashville music. And most of those shows were live shows, so people weren't lip-syncing. So
like
you'd
Roy
see,
Clark? He used to play every show.
Well, my grandmother watched Lawrence Welk, and that's where I first heard it.
No, I said Roy
music.
Clark.
Yeah. No, Roy Clark I saw on Hee Haw, and he would play live. And there was an Odd Couple episode.
He'd play every show.
Yeah. There was an Odd Couple episode with Roy Clark where he played his own version of Malaguena that was just incredible.
What about Chet Atkins? You like him?
I did. One of the first records I had as a kid was one called Solo Flight, and that's just a badass record. I mean, anybody who's really interested in guitar playing could do worse than seek that record out. But my overall favorite guitar player, you know, just on a country guitar player level, was a guy who played on Nashville Skyline. His name was Norman Blake.
And, Bob Dylan.
What's that? Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash. He's all over the O Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack. Plus, he made a lot of records in the 70s for Rounder that are just great masterpieces of guitar playing. And then kind of I went right from that to trying to play like Johnny Ramone and Steve Jones.
Right.
And
Johnny Thunders.
Not so much him. You know who was like the first guy I really tried to learn a lot of solos by in the world of punk rock or something like it? It was Andy Partridge. On those first couple of XTC records, was just like slam. Yeah. The playing on This Is Pop. I mean, everything on the first 4 XTC albums was amazing. Mark Morland on the Wall of Voodoo albums, like one of the most underrated guitar.
You know the band he was in before that, the Skulls.
I know about the Skulls, but I never. And you know, I've
his
since played
too.
With Stan Ridgway, and you know, Stan was sort of. He said, "Well, you know, if you really like that stuff, let's hear you play Back in Flesh." Ha ha ha. Bang, 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 bang.
You showed him?
I spent a whole summer in my bedroom with a copy of Dark Continent learning that one out. And he was like, "Want to be on my new record?" And then he made me play like Wes Montgomery. And then kind of the next big guy was Andy Gill. you know, from Gang of Four. He just floored me. Him, Viv Albertine from the Slits. Because it was so radically different from...
She played kind of like reggae.
Yeah, but she also had some different stuff. She's a very
interesting player. Do you know the cat? There was a... I heard of somebody before the Gang of Four. Well, obviously the pop group and those guys,
yeah.
Garth and Waddington, I think, was the other guitarist.
Yeah.
But there was this blues thing in England called... Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah.
A guy named Wilco.
Wilco, and there was...
And he kind of had that weird kind of guitar thing.
He did, and there was another guitar player on that scene who wound up playing with Graham Parker, and his name was Brinchley Schwartz.
Yeah.
And, you know...
That was a tight group.
Yeah, that was the thing, man. His guitar solos, they're like Dave Alvin's guitar solos, where, you know, they're not necessarily flashy. But they're difficult to learn, and they're very, very well placed. You know, these are people that just... My philosophy of guitar playing is like, you know, there are a lot of... I mean, I don't have Nels Klein's hands, so I can't just, like, flatten you with, like, that kind of statistical density. Yeah. And I don't have Frizzell's sense of, you know, shaping the notes and using effects boxes and painting with sound. So I just try to get in... Get out and make sure that what I put in front of you was the right thing to put in front of you. Kind of a Curtis Mayfield approach.
Well, or I was thinking John Fogerty was.
Fogerty is another one.
His solos, no.
There's no fat on
notes. There's no, yeah, no fat.
Yeah, I.
His own was really into him.
I just really always, you know, like.
I think kind of into Scotty Moore.
We're all really into Scotty Moore. I mean, it's impossible to be a thinking person and not love certain portions of Elvis Presley's career. Yeah, you know, Elvis Presley's just, I mean, that was my first concert, and I'm still recovering from it. And, you know, you listen to, well, I have all those bootlegs of the Sun Sessions, and hearing how, you know, things developed, you realize Scotty Moore was just
architectural. What don't you like about guitar? What makes you do a Jimmy Reed on something?
What makes me do a Jimmy Reed on something? Usually if somebody does a Jimmy Page on something, you know? No, I don't like... When I hear more note, when I hear more notes than I can process, I don't like that. You know, that's like somebody. It's like when I hear a rap record where somebody's just freestyling way too fast and rhyming anything. It makes me want to go back and put on the Sugar Hill Gang because I can hear every word. And when I don't like guitars, when there's just too much of it coming at me. I mean, there are guys who can do very dense stuff that's got a lot of notes.
Now,
but that it's got, like, a big swing and dick and comes in with attitude. And, like, you listen to Eddie Van Halen on So This Is Love, and that's just like...
When's the first time you heard Jimmy?
When's the first time I heard Jimi Hendrix, or...
Yeah.
My uncle had the record. So...
Experience.
Yeah, he had Are You Experienced, and, that record, I don't remember if I heard that or, Fire by Arthur Brown first. But those were two records that my parents didn't have. So when I was at my grandmother's house, I would put those on, and they were like this... it was like sneaky to me, because they weren't like other records. And if I got caught operating the stereo, so it was a very nasty, evil little thrill. But hearing if Six Was Not... Or no, sorry, Third Stone from the Sun.
Oh, yeah, great bass line.
That dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. And just that bang, because when I first heard Andy Gill with Gang of Four, I immediately related it to the opening of that, because I'm pretty sure that Armalite Rifle is based on the opening of that, because it's that same chord before he goes to the bum, 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 bum. So Hendrix was something to me that was like, is around his cartoons. And it's only later in life that I went back and went like,
yeah.
Whoa, as ubiquitous as this was.
That's right. He's
this is so
sourced by everyone.
Yeah, I mean, and the stuff that I look at and just go like, or hear myself quoting.
Did you ever listen to Funkadelic in the old days?
Oh hell! Oh, I grew up in Philadelphia, so
Eddie Hazel.
Well, yeah, I was going to say Maggot Brain was just everybody's older brother played Maggot Brain. My favorite was Uncle Jam Wants You. I just thought that was like one of the smokinest records, and Cosmic Slop. And, of course, you know, Flashlight and Tear the Roof and, you know...
Now, you're in a trio, so you got a drummer?
Yeah, it's drums, upright bass, and
bass.
I'm mostly...
So what do you like about drummers?
My favorite drummers are always the ones that can hear something coming from a mile away and set it up and push it to the next direction. One of the drummers I always make my drummers listen to is George Hurley.
Yeah.
Because George, man, could set up a groove and then just capsize it. And I love that. And the cut I always make him listen to, believe it or not, is Candle in the Flame.
Oh.
I just always thought that was, like, perfect drumming. Levon Helm is another drummer I love because it's just like, here's the groove. It's just thick, and it's like chocolate cake and whiskey. You just can't get up from it. And
what about bass? What do you like about bass?
What do I like about bass? Again,
who's your stand-up player?
It's Paul Ekman, who was in Bone Breaks group, Orchestra Superstring.
Oh, who's your drummer we didn't say?
Oh, Dale Daniel, who was with the Hacienda Brothers.
Okay.
Usually it had been Bone Break for years and years, or another cat named Howard Green, but Bone Break was on tour doing X this summer, and when Chris Gaffney died, the Hacienda Brothers cats were at Liberty, and if someone's good enough for Chris Gaffney, they're just good enough. And Dale's been great, and we play up in Bakersfield about every week. So
it's Buck Owens later.
Buck Owens, Merle Haggard, Win Stewart. Yeah, believe me, I've got...
So what do you like about bass?
What I like about bass? Well, great bass players have a way of outlining the whole arrangement. Not just keeping time, but putting the punctuation in the music. Here's the paragraph. Here's the sentence. Here's the, like the whole end-to-end architecture of the song. And if I was going to give you an indication, I would pick something like California Girls by the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
Because the way the bass frames that picture. Carol's one of the bass players on it. I used Carol on a couple of sessions, and she's just, like, wicked intuitive. She can look at a piece of music and know what you mean before she even knows what it sounds like.
She's incredible.
Yeah. Also, I'd say McCartney's playing on Rain. You're playing on Dream Told by Modo. It's just like that's just like such a weird bass line. And you can't really play that song on the radio too often these days. But I was just like,
you know, the last Fridays of the month in the old days, they'd test the air raid sirens. That's
with
where
that
came from.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Fridays. Last Friday, they and that one was right by D. Boone's pad, the projects at Park Western. And so. We had a buddy named... Yeah, but they don't use
them. They don't use them anymore. We had those.
And no, those projects ain't there. It's called Tarragona. No, all that got rolled over. There's track
the
holes now.
The siren's still there.
I doubt it. I doubt it. They rolled that whole thing.
Well, there's one standing off of Channel. Like, you know how Channel goes
up? Yeah, but we were up at Battery in Park Western.
Yeah.
And the only part of Battery left... They even changed names of the streets. They got big Spanish names now. Via Tarragona. So.
Yeah.
Camino's a meal.
You know, they pick... You know how that development crap goes.
Yeah.
And like, because it was an old Navy housing, and so it had names of sailors, and like Battery, right? But anyway, this guy, friend of ours, Danny Moto, he would always... It was the same...
There was an actual Moto?
His name was Danny Salvador because he was... His mother was from Japan, and we were such kind... Children.
Well, yes, Danny, children are often tolerant.
Danny used to call D. Boone Fat Man, right, with his ma there. And so Danny was Danny Moto. Okay, so.
And so that was Danny's thing, was, you know.
No, he had his theory. Look, let's say the missiles are coming, the bombs are coming, and the siren's going off. That means you could go and get women, and you wouldn't get arrested for it because the law.
Sort of like that part at the end of Dogma.
World War III. When I first heard that was so, like, I was so
great. Like Danny, we've heard this about 30 times every month. You got to hear this dream. You know, it's like you're kind of into it.
But
of course, we were just
before we lose the thread on this other bass line. I just think like, if you want to find out what I like about the electric bass, listen to White Girl by X.
John Doe
and DJ Bonebreak on that record, just that was something that was an absolute.
He used a lot of fifths.
He's well recorded. You played that that show with DJ Bonebreak, kind of sight unseen, in Sierra Madre.
Yeah, with a buddy of his, Chris.
Yeah, Chris.
That was really
Chris
good.
Murphy.
What's funny is I was going, come on, do some old hippie jam, you know.
It's kind of from his neighborhood, right?
Yeah, I grew up a few blocks from there, Sierra Madre. And,
not a lot of gigs. I think the only volunteer fire department
still
in the county.
Well, I still think you mean the Bonebreaker. And I mean,
well, my next question is
really
going to
be together.
What do you like about trios?
What I like about trios, I'm one of those people that thinks the more people in a band, the less intuitive the playing becomes. Three people is like the ultimate colloquy because nobody has all the the duties of rhythm or all the duties of harmony or all the duties of melody on them, because you got three people that can, and it can be any three instruments. It can be organ, guitar, drums, or
oh, that's interesting bass you music. Say that, because I was doing an interview with the German magazine Specs, you know, and the guy was telling me that even with the symphony, the human mind only concentrates on three things at a time.
Probably, I would believe that.
So but if you're hearing a big symphony, you're actually focusing in on these.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. And my thinking is just, you know, whether you're talking about the Jimi Hendrix Experience or X or the Bill Evans Trio, yeah. If you got three guys who really know the role of their instruments playing together in the culture of their band, so to speak.
Once I saw Tal Farlow, Warren Marsh, and Tootie Heath.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah, well, you know, Tal is just one of the... I played with Tootie, and that was... the thing is, like, if you got three guys that really know their role amongst each other, all three things will kind of evolve their way to the surface in the hands of different musicians. And that's why I like trios. It's just the intimacy.
Well, what about duets?
Oh, it depends on who you're playing duets with.
Well, you're going to do one now with Brother Matt and Spencer.
Thank you. Oh, come about, Roy.
Thank you so much, Skip.
Yeah, cool.
I apologize for everybody that had to sit through that. That's way too long a guitar solo, especially out of me.
Well, you got to.
I was going to wear my overalls, and then I thought nobody else will be wearing overalls.
And now we're at the end of second hour of November 9th, 2008. Wild from Pedro show. Hold tight for hour 3. November 9th, 2008, it's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro Show.
Thank you.
Watt from Pedro show. Started the third hour off with Benefit for Mr. Tight by Nino Trinca. You would know what that means. Nino Trinca?
I know the Jesse doesn't work, but at least I don't like ignorant guy in the show, you know.
No, oh, Quimby.
I'm going to talk to you in a second. Let me say the songs. Then after that, we had Samantra Itu by Golden Monkeys, and then Memory 4AM by Takeshi Nishimoto, and finally, we had Stay Don't Go by Hoa Trang An, which means Ancient Flower of Hanoi. These are some ladies from Vietnam that play their traditional music. Now, Guido.
Guido. Guido's terrible.
Giovanni. I'm sorry.
Giovanni. You know, in the U.S., yeah, it's Giovanni.
Huh? Giovanni, yeah. What does the meaning Allure. Of Guido is?
Guido's a generic term for an Italian.
Yeah,
okay. Sounds bad.
Yeah.
Like, you guys might say U.S. guys are Joes.
Okay. Or Yankees or whatever.
Actually, there are guys in Italy named Guido, though, so when you hear that, it's like, whoa.
Father Guido Sordo.
Yeah, so Guido is
find the Pope's in a pizza.
Not a total pejorative. But anyway, you're on a tour.
Yeah, I'm finishing a project on cities that I started to do in New York in 2002.
Yeah.
And so I'm traveling around cities.
Right, and you got hooked up through this couch surfing?
Yeah, just looked on couch surfing and...
Couchsurfing.com, and so you're touring... How do you get from town to town?
I actually just live in France, nearby Luxembourg, took a plane nearly directly to Los Angeles and just
what's
landed.
What's the next target?
That's actually Los Angeles is like my last target the of final. A project. I just will do a little bit of Las Vegas. But
that's not a whole lot of
that's
couch.
Kind of a parenthesis. No, it's not a lot of couch, no. Okay. But it's a long
you don't
time
know
in a
economy.
Single couch. Yeah. And I have to thank Pete for that. It's
yeah, Pete, you're righteous and generous. Come, cow.
Okay. Come. That means you're hungry.
How do you say that?
Kapkumkap.
Kapkumkap. Kapkumkap. Yeah. The ladies say different than the guys.
Kapkumkap.
Yeah. Ignorant of Thai. What? Slow learner. Slow learner.
But yeah, couch surfers have different purposes. Giovanni's just here for one project for 3 weeks. And that's all I gotta say, you know. Some people like traveling around the world, like that. There was a couch surfer that just left. I had another one that.
Yeah, Mark Stangroom.
No, another.
In between.
Together. There's a lot of men in her life. Why?
The couch and goes.
On her couch in her life.
But that can't
you
be all you have.
As you wish.
That can't be all you have to say. You must have some kind of beef.
Not that. Well, the last one actually kind of contacted me like, I need a couch tonight, right? I'm like, wait. So he comes like the following day, which was Friday. Actually, I have three that night, all over the place. But yeah, that one actually was interesting. He's like on this crazy trip where he's only like he hitchhiked. He spend a night in each city and going, you know.
You got certain rules he travels by?
I don't know if he's safe, I guess. I don't know.
No, only one night here.
Yeah, no, because I think, you know, he was just kind of on the move, and then he'll be in China by next week or something. But
so you have an issue with their safety?
I don't have... Are you trying to make me flip out on something? I think that's what you were trying to do. It's like, next to you here is like, we went to spend the evening of the election day going around the different places to see the reaction of people. And actually, I'm a little bit disappointed, but it was what it was. We were waiting for pizza.
You wanted Nuremberg Valley?
No sardines or what?
Or subtle nerd.
Yeah. Nice or what?
Tact.
I don't know what you just did, but anyway.
They didn't know it was a bore.
Yeah, this is
joke.
The first show since the the beauty contest.
We went to the Democratic Democrats official party in
Politburo?
Century City.
Well, that was your problem. You went to Century City, not Englewood.
Right.
one of my I live in Englewood. One of my neighbors like calls me up, holds them. Listen to Crenshaw Boulevard,
oh, wow,
and it sounded
wow.
like James Brown live at the Apollo Volume One out there. It was slamming.
I had a gig in Long Beach, and I was driving there to D. Piazza's, and there was a cat, a younger man, maybe early 20s, young black man, kind of, assertive thing, but he was waving a flag, a U.S. flag, and he was into it.
Well, how often do you see a moment in American history, or I can't really say anything about the rest of the world because governments turn in the rest of the world. France every few years, it's like new government, almost a whole new country. But in this country, it doesn't really work like that. So to see a lot of young people showing up to vote and being optimistic instead of going, yeah, they're all crooks. Who gives a And to see these assertive young people going, why aren't you registered to vote? Was like...
Well, you know,
I went to the polls early, and when they opened at 7, and there was a lot of people. My first election was Jimmy Carter and Gerry Ford in 76.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been through a few of them, and it was a lot different waiting in line. There was a lot of folks that seemed that hadn't been part of the dealio.
Well, you have Bush to thank for that. I mean, without the years and years of all this crap that's going on, people wouldn't be, wouldn't be motivated to get involved so much.
What'd you think of Cynthia McKinney?
I have my own ideas about the extremists on the left too, because I kind of firmly believe on Obama just because he was a little bit more centrist, and I think we needed that to bridge all the differences that we have existing.
Mm-hmm.
We can't just swing from one side to the other and expect everything in between to fall into place. We need somebody to actually sort of, cushion it.
Mm-hmm.
Cynthia McKinney has ideologies that I admire extremely, but I just feel like it's not going to work if you try to swing too.
So yeah, Peak is really right here. I mean, like, one of the things...
You know, people with funny clothes get to come to Disneyland.
Yeah, but here's the other side of it is, pragmatism will a pragmatist will always win over an ideologue, because an ideologue is walking in there with what you should do. A pragmatist is somebody who walks in there and goes, what do we need to get
done?
Yeah,
but I thought the slogan was change and stuff. How do you change if you don't...
A good plan today is better than the perfect plan tomorrow. Think about this. As we sit here, it's 76 days before Barack Obama takes office. So he can have all the meetings he wants. He can have all the referendum, press conference, proposal, this, that, and the other. But somebody else is still at the switch. And 76 days, when Rome is on fire, is 76 days when Rome is on fire.
It could be an eternity.
Yeah, exactly.
They have notions of doing things. I mean, these executive orders to permanently overturn certain environmental things that... That's okay.
Waiting for them to...
The imperial
why presence. Can't he turn them back?
They make it really hard to do that.
Yeah. The way law is written means you have to vote on turning
his party's
back.
Got control of the Congress.
No, but he's off the executive powers to where they can't be overruled. It is sort of like a...
No, what documents the Constitution?
They haven't had shown any respect for the Constitution. I mean, Bush would be signing a new bill into law and adding stuff.
But they're out.
They're still, the one thing that you under...
They've got the Supreme Court to back their issues, though, when it comes to that, and it goes to the Supreme Court.
It's the same guys who turned the stuff over are the same guys you have to answer to, because we're not talking about pieces of legislation now. We're talking about laws with precedents.
and you have to go to the Supreme Court, who are the same evil, heartless fuckers that...
The way I was taught civics is Congress makes laws, and then people, if they find them unconstitutional, bring them to the court. The executive branch is there to carry out the law of the land. Now, I think it's got blurred, and people don't talk about it. They talk about the president as leader and stuff like that, but he can make decisions and stuff, but people can take those to the court.
Right, but you still, the problem is you're going to the same court that said, okay, we find this law this way to be constitutional,
yeah.
And you are not going to get those guys to overturn some shit they said 6 months ago. That's like, hey, we were wrong 6 months ago.
Yeah.
You know, and this is why, of all the duties that President Obama will have, none will be more lasting than the appointment of Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. And this is like a very important thing in the age of Prop 8, in the age of, you know, right-wing extremists challenging Roe v. Wade, and on down the line.
Well, Prop 8 was a referendum brought to voters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It wasn't an executive
order. But you usually don't come in with something that tells you what you can't do.
Right.
Are they going to, you know, overturn voting rights?
Well, that's the thing is,
it is really, you know, unconstitutional.
First of all,
totally.
Law is not something you vote on. That's what the Supreme Court is there for. Mm-hmm. Like them or not, they're the ones who say, we know the law.
Congress makes the law, and then you vote for the representatives that are in Congress.
Okay, yeah.
But when you have to take it into...
Somebody takes it, they find it a problem with it, so they take it to the court.
The Supreme Court, yeah, and what they say goes. Now...
Yeah, but there's...
And that's it. There was, last year, California challenged its ability... California wanted to use its ability to say states' rights on stricter pollution controls. Supreme Court voted 8-1 to strike that down and say, no, you don't. Mm-hmm. And yet these were some of the same people many years ago before they were in there that thought states' rights were, the thing. They should be, really. But so they came in and just said, sorry, California, you have to follow the federal. And there's no appeal on that.
Yeah, I mean...
There's nowhere else to go with
that. The Supreme Court...
No, somebody makes another law, right? And then it'll go before the court again, and this stuff happens all the time.
Yeah, and look how long it takes to make that stuff happen.
That's right.
So
I think they want things to kind of move slow too, so things don't get too carried away.
That's another thing, is that, you know, it's basically like leaving the first chamber of your gun blank so you don't misfire. You know, you got to think before you take the shot. So all the things we're talking about don't happen quickly. And well, you know, you're President Obama. You're basically walking in to lead a country that's on fire. From five different, you know, the trees are on fire, the road is on fire, hell, the river's on fire. Which one do you put out first? And I got news for you. You know, like, Prop 8 is not even going to be on the second page.
Well, I think he's in his job as commander-in-chief of the armed forces, so there's some decisions there that probably...
Yeah. No, that stuff's on the first page,
I mean, that's
too.
Part of his job description.
Yeah. Commander-in-chief.
Huh? The military, when you join, you take an oath to defend the Constitution.
Well, what's happened the last few years is the guys put their hand on the Constitution and defend the Bible. You know, we got to switch that back over.
And take the Fifth Amendment.
Well, he can make decisions.
I'm not going to talk about it.
To bring the money up, you know, the Congress has to okay the money. I mean, it's what's it called? Separation of powers, checks and balances.
Yeah, checks and balances.
Right now we have to deal with reality. But yet, Obama could come out and say we need some of these WPA-type programs, which could have a double-bang effect. For instance, I mean, we're going to see more collapsing bridges. You know, there was a sinkhole in Pasadena, this thing in Minnesota, where that's infrastructure.
Yeah.
And that is falling apart, too. And so, if you're going to try and create
jobs... Yeah,
you got
this weird role that's
to,
not... The president, the president got a role that was not in the Constitution. You present a budget.
Yeah.
That's not in there. But they do that to try to bring a focus or something, I guess.
Well, it's also...
Money's all supposed to be dealt with... See, this is the thing. I think in the elections that get left out, it's just talking about how the game is supposed to work. We look at them as just figures and slogans, and we don't really have an understanding of how the government works. Mm-hmm. And so people, they're voting for people, they don't really know their jobs. It gets strange. All of a sudden, they represent all kinds of things, personalities, you know? One thing I hope about the election, though, is people who didn't win don't get too angry and disenfranchised.
I don't think they will, just because we got a guy who knows how to speak to people.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's an important thing. The other thing is, I mean, much respect to John McCain. When somebody tried to shout out or shout down, you know, the notion of President Obama as he was giving the consolation speech, he said no and made sure to use the term my president. You know, he was very gracious. If he had been that guy on the campaign trail, we might be all having a group suicide party thinking, oh, God, Sarah Palin.
Well, his campaign was really bad.
I think Bush's speech, too, saying this guy won.
Yeah, no,
he was probably the best speech that I heard from him.
Yeah, he's extremely sincere.
He did, one of the few times. But McCain was running
this before his damn dog bit a reporter, which I thought was the...
So it's kind of trippy.
But McCain was running this.
I'm glad people are talking about how power is dealt with in the United States. And not just such kind of abstract, like I said, like facets of personality.
Let me throw something down here. But I'm sorry, Peek, you go first.
Oh, I'm just going to switch to how I am also amazed how internationally people are so excited about this person.
Yeah, but that's because we're the biggest, baddest country there is.
Yeah.
And instead of a cowboy up front, we have like a guy who's actually going, I'll talk to anybody who I think can keep the United States safe. And I thought that was a very cool answer.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
we
become like the Russians when I remember going to Portugal in 1980, a weak economy, and you see the sickle and hammer tattooed everywhere that the Russians overreached. But now, I was in Greece when Reagan was elected, and they had their thing of him showing a peace sign with dual gun barrels. You know, he was seen as the next Hitler. And we now have become the ones that are going and taking over and trying to exert that ugly side. I mean, Guantanamo Bay, all that's not a...
But that's exactly what I was kind of
leaning
to.
And it, you know,
is you're speaking about the abstractions of power. Like, forget the abstractions for a second. Let's actually demystify the job. You know, in other words, like getting rid of Gitmo. Dude, you know, this is a building.
So
this is where this bad stuff is.
I think his people are already talking about there's a need for it.
Really?
Will you be disappointed if that happens?
A need for what?
Gitmo.
What do you mean a need? I mean, there's a need to let the buildings at Dock House stand so we never forget what was done.
No,
but Gitmo,
no,
they need to clear out.
No, no.
That's a Rod Serling.
I'm not talking about that.
But Gitmo, what
I'm
is it?
I'm talking about a functional part of the military.
Well, then they better have a good PR campaign.
Yeah.
Position that we're not there to waterboard and hold people without charging them for years. I mean, that's not the American way.
One person?
I'm just telling you. That might be the reality.
Yeah. Well,
what do you
that's
do?
Another thing, too. That's like,
next election, you're more careful with your
you
choice, or what?
Many high hopes that I'm afraid that people might not get everything they want, and they, you know, people have, like, everybody seems to have, like, their own idea of what's the priority, you know, and they're going to start going, like, well, when is he going to get around to our issue?
Yeah, they only talk about a few
topics
the whole election.
Everybody is so emotionally invested in this election that they feel like they're part of it, and...
That's a good point.
Yeah,
well, that's why the economy,
so
I mean, if people don't have a job, I mean, I read today, 14... The lowest, highest job and unemployment rate in 15 years. That's
I got laid off last
underemployed. I'm one that's not seen as seeking work because I'm not on the charts because I do freelance and they don't see that. But underemployed, you know, not getting as much consulting or a lot of people. If they actually Clinton changed the definition of unemployment, I read an interesting article. Actually, it's really at about 14%, which is double what you know they have it at.
Yeah.
So you're thinking about things. That's good. Let's hear some more music.
Watt from Pedro show. Started off our last chunk of music for the edition, our early November edition of the Watt from Pedro show with Everything Is Sinking by Yuko Amada. Then we heard Shit from Fury Curry. Then Belly of the Beast by Sunken Landscapes. Untitled Number 3 by the Lost and Found Sound. Stay Low by Migration and Dar Philosopher's Stone. Sorry.
I'm just a stupid fuck.
Dar Philosopher's Stone by Mr. Stephen H. Antonio. So I was very inspired by guys' enlightening discussion and picked them songs accordingly. I'm optimistic. Hopefully.
That pause was not reassuring. What?
What's that mean?
Well, what's it mean? It means that I'm optimistic that people's hopes are high and maybe they'll get involved. Because I don't think you can abrogate responsibility to a leader and expect things to really change. I think people, if they got involved enough to vote me, they get involved in
other
stuff.
It'll be a participative democracy, maybe. I think that's what Obama's really, he knows he needs that. I mean, one man isn't going to do that.
Well, I think now that people have found out that they can go vote and they can do that and that they won't get arrested and that fires won't break out and that the earth does not crumble and the sky does not darken, they might actually go, you know, I have a stake in this. I want more or less of this in my neighborhood or more or less of this in my PTA or, you know. One of the ways the Republicans, you know, back in the old Lee Atwater days kind of came to power was to start at the extremely local level, precinct delegates, PTA and all that. And now that especially young people have gotten involved and have seen, like, we can get a president in there, getting a mayor in there doesn't seem like such a big deal comparatively. And I think people, you know, acting on a local level, that's the key to it.
But sadly enough, I don't think there's too many people who are running for offices that have such foresight on the community level. You know, it's just still... You know,
there's always somebody in every local election, there's somebody at some level that you look at and go, that guy's really cool. And I don't think, yes, there is.
Okay.
I mean, I've been astounded, you know, because I started voting the minute I could start voting against Ronald Reagan, damn it, my boots were on the ground. And there was always somebody that was either angry at the same stuff I was angry at for the same reasons or introducing some new idea that I had not thought of. And then there's also the thing of, like, bond issues and things like that, which are community-centered issues. I don't think despondency or hopelessness are the things that are called for right now. I don't think, well, what's the point? There's not going to be another guy.
Yeah, but when were they ever called for?
No, but especially now that we have seen that we can do the impossible, which is to get a guy who doesn't look like the guy on your money into the Oval Office.
Right. Yeah, but I don't think it's all about looks.
No, but I'm saying, you know, everybody said, you know.
Well, but I did, because I called it a beauty pageant.
I really don't think it's about looks. It's not about looks, I think, you know. He entered in politics words that didn't exist in politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, I never heard a president doing a campaign on we instead of I. Mm-hmm. I never heard one person running for president or prime minister saying dialogue. You know, he's using words that never been used in politics. He used hope, he used we, he used dialogue. And then he said one thing that no politician ever said in history is, I'll not be able to save this country in one mandate. Mm-hmm. I will not maybe even be able to save it in two mandates if you don't help me. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. How many politicians have been honest about
Roosevelt,
the shit we are in? I mean, I live in France and there is a widget saying that yesterday it was a liberal and that only liberalism will be saving the world. And there is the crisis, and a week later he's like, the state has to do everything. And, you know, it's like, he's changing his mind all the time. In Italy we have an even worse widget that said that...
He's back in.
That he's back in, and 53% of people voted him, and I'm ashamed of it. And the guy is saying...
Welcome
oh,
to America,
you know, 2004. You know, he just said, like, last time, oh, American new president is... intelligent, handsome, and talented.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, it's my freaking prime minister.
Yeah.
You know, it's like...
But you know what?
You said that in the street in front of a guy, a black guy, and killed you, you know? It's just like... And he's prime minister and said that.
On the other hand, thank you for Chick-fil-A.
Not necessarily, I don't know. I think the thing with Obama is that he appeared more presidential, and I think a lot of people lost sight of the race thing just because... he seems like the kind of person you'd want. And now that we become more multi-ethnic, and it's the percentages you can see with LA Unified or anywhere else, the demographics are going that way. Is now it's a question of more of the true melting pot. Is that shouldn't matter anymore. It's about a common goal that people can unite around instead of being, I'm the divider.
Yeah, but I hope honesty is the new marketing of politics, you know.
Right.
It's like, it's all about marketing a product.
Yeah.
And he's the first one marketed it as, I'm honest, I tell you what I think,
mm-hmm.
and I win.
Well,
so next time there is a guy
smart.
That will say,
yeah,
"You look, I tell what I think, and that's my truth." And you said just before, you know, McCain may be lost because he wasn't the honest and truth McCain.
Well, how many times can you scare people with the boogeyman's hiding behind a bush? And he has...
It's worked almost every election.
He's a terrorist. It's too far, too radical.
Okay,
you know,
okay. We're running out of time. Sorry. I'd like to go on.
And goodbye, Sarah Palin.
I didn't want to bring any of that up.
Well, what would Dave Luna say? He'd have really been fired up.
Right. What would D Boone think? That's a great way to shut show down. All you people, thanks for coming aboard, huh?
Thank you for inviting me, Watt. It's been an honor.
Tyler, Big, Talia, Matt.
Thank you for inviting the most beautiful women in all of Los Angeles County.
Woo!
Damn right.
And Bob and Brother Matt always for aiding and abetting. The Watt from Pedro show, November 9th, 2008. Keep your powder dry.